Good evening. My name is Walter Armbrust. I'm a fellow of the Middle East Center. You haven't seen me here previously this term because I'm on sabbatical. I came out of sabbatical for tonight. And it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Ibrahim Al-Marashi. It's not the first time I've introduced him. He comes here fairly frequently, and he was our own student. He graduated in 2004 in the history department and is now an associate professor of history at California State University, San Marcos. He's a historian of 20th century Iraq. His dissertation was on the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and the 1991 Gulf War. As you'll have seen from the Middle East Center website, Ibrahim's work was plagiarized by the British government when it was trying to fabricate a rationale for joining the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. And this was informally known, or maybe it's official now, I don't know, as the Dodgy Dossier case. Ibrahim is the co-author of a number of works, including Iraq's Armed Forces and Analytical History, which was published in 2008, The Modern History of Iraq in 2017, and A Concise History of the Modern Middle East in 2018. And all of these were published by Routledge. And he's currently researching the effects of climate change on Iraq. And before the pandemic, he had developed an interest in pandemics. And so he went through a kind of intense period of teaching like 15 different variations of classes on pandemics during the pandemic. But he just told me that now the pandemic is over and people are starting to become less interested in that topic. But of course, it's still a fascinating topic and possibly relevant to tonight's lecture. The title of tonight's lecture is The Transformation of Iraq Since the 2003 Invasion, From the Dodgy Dossier to Human Security, Gender, and the Nation's Future in the Face of Climate Change. As usual, Ibrahim will speak for 45, 50 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions afterwards. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Ibrahim Al-Marashi.
Very good. First of all, I wanted to thank you. I realize it's the last day of term. Fortunately, at least the weather improved, so I'm grateful for that. As Walter introduced me, yes, I did my DPhil here. I graduated in 2004. At that time, I was writing a thesis on the 1991 Gulf War. When it was finished, it was perhaps the most recent thesis in the modern history department at Oxford at the time. I'll tell you a particular episode of one chapter of that thesis, but after the publication of the thesis, I also had the pleasure of coming back here in 2004. Walter introduced me for another subject that I was researching, and that was the beginning of the use of beheadings as a tool of terrorism by then and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. At that time, somebody affiliated with the organization known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq that would eventually evolve into ISIS. So there is a thread that unites what seems disparate subjects. And first of all, I have tried to, at the end of this seminar series, is first of all, how will the history of Iraq since the last 20 years be written? What were the major episodes? What were the major milestones? This is what I wanted to go over. And when I first pitched this subject back in September, the entire lecture series came out of that, looking at Iraq over the last 20 years. I asked to be the final speaker because I not only want to refer to some of the previous speakers, but reflect on the last 20 years, and then by bringing in climate change, also look at the most salient subject going into the next 20 years. So what I'm going to, first of all, basically look at is the one overarching theme is the ramification of the consequences of the collapse of the security sector in 2003, with the argument that the effects are still being felt today. Okay? Particularly, the record of governance since 2003 intersects with instability and will only be exacerbated in the future with climate change. So what I'm going to do is then look at the nexus with the collapse of the security sector and with climate change. What does that bode in terms of Iraq's future? It's more or less this, and for some who I notice are quite young, what am I going to try to introduce you to, for you might be children during the Iraq War, was a time when the survival of the Iraqi state was in doubt. So what I want to conclude with is, first of all, how has Iraq survived? How has the state evolved despite the odds? So as I said, I'll be looking at more or less over the last 20 years, four themes. The collapse of the security sector and the consequent rise of violent non-state actors in Iraq. Then kind of look at going from the domestic to a brief overview of the regional context, as we are in the present from the last 20 years. How has the region more or less been affected by the Iraq War? And then go back to Iraq, reflect on the loss of Iraq's ethno-sectarian heterogeneity, and then finally look at the future of Iraq and climate change. So in other words, the thesis I suppose I wrote really fell into history, but I had ramifications in the literature of national security. When I was doing my thesis in Oxford, I was also working with an NGO called Child Soldiers International. And that was more or less working in the field of human security. I was attending a lecture recently on women in the Gulf, and a colleague of mine, somebody I've worked for a long time, named Rend Rahim, who opened the Iraq Foundation in the US. During that lecture, she lamented the kind of, let's say, the inability of the field of national security to talk to other fields in which we use the word security. We use terms such as energy security, and usually energy security and national security are kind of served on a continuum, but her regret was that the field of human security, that looks at the kind of the most vulnerable populations in conflict, right, is usually their scholars are working in their own field, and then, you know, runs food security is a term we use, water security, finally climate security. I'm going to try to kind of create a common link through all these fields by particularly looking at the collapse of the security sector. So first, let's take you back in time. It's February 2003. And why has the famed Brazilian author Paulo Coelho is writing a thank you letter to Bush, where he refers to not only Colin Powell, but making it necessary for Tony Blair to go to the British Parliament with a fabricated dossier written by a student, that's me, 10 years ago, and present this as damning evidence collected by the British Secret Service. So when Colin Powell had passed, this was perhaps his darkest blemish on his diplomatic and military career. That presentation in February 2003, where he was approaching the UN General Assembly, but really it was this kind of a venue to advocate for a UN Security Council resolution to further justify military action against Iraq. Let's go back in 2003 and look at the following video to remind us of what happened then. Just to remind you, it's February 2003.
Heralded by love.
Okay.
The government's carefully coordinated propaganda offensive took an embarrassing hit tonight after Downing Street was accused of plagiarism. The target is an intelligence dossier released on Monday and heralded by none other than US Secretary of State Colin Powell at the United Nations yesterday. Channel 4 News has learned that the bulk of this 19-page document was copied from three different articles, one written by a graduate student. Our defense specialist, Julian Rush, has the details.
I will try to...
On Monday, the day before the US Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the UN, Downing Street published its latest paper on Iran. It gives the impression of being an up-to-the-minute, intelligence-based analysis, and Mr. Powell was fulsome in his praise.
I would call my colleagues' attention to the fine paper that the United Kingdom distributed yesterday, which describes in exquisite detail Iraqi deception activities.
Published on the number 10 website and called Iraq, its infrastructure of concealment, deception, and intimidation, it outlines the structure of Saddam's intelligence organizations. It makes familiar reading to a Cambridge academic.
Many of the words and phrases that he used I recalled from another context. So I searched around the other articles that I'd read on Iraq's organizations, its military and security organizations, and realized that large sections of the British government's dossier were actually copied.
Copied from here, an article last September in a small journal, the Middle East Review of International Affairs. Its author, Ibrahim Al-Marashi, a postgraduate student from Monterey in California.
The document, the British government dossier, is 19 pages long, most of pages 6 to 16 are copied directly from that document.
Word for word.
Word for word. Even the grammatical errors and typographical.
Not to indeed appear verbatim. This, for example, six paragraphs long on Saddam's special security organization. The exact same words are in the Californian student's paper. Of military intelligence, Al-Murashi writes, the head of military intelligence generally did not have to be a relative of Saddam's immediate family, nor a Tikriti. Saddam appointed Sabir Abdulaziz al-Duri as head. Note the comma after appointed. Downing Street paraphrases the first sentence, but the second is cut and pasted, complete with the same grammatical error. Academics take plagiarism seriously. It's intellectual theft. Downing Street didn't ask for permission to reproduce the work, which is not current, but actually an historical analysis of the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait before the last Gulf War.
He's writing his PhD thesis on the operation of Iraqi forces inside Kuwait, and his primary source of information is documents captured from the Iraqi government in 1991. The information, therefore, that he is using is 12 years old, and he acknowledges this in his article. The British government, when it transplants that information into its own dossier, does not make that acknowledgement. So it is presented as current information about Iraq's current security services, when really the information which he is using are some 12 years old.
Downing Street copied from two other articles from the magazine Jane's Intelligence Review. Its editor is happy to be quoted, less happy at the selective way some parts were edited. What you want to need to look at is exactly how it's been compiled and collated. And the questions that you're asking about, has certain things been selected for spin, are right questions to be asked. In several places, Downing Street edits the originals to make more sinister reading. Number 10 says the main intelligence agency is spying on foreign embassies in Iraq. The original read, monitoring foreign embassies in Iraq. And the provocative role of supporting terrorist organizations in hostile regimes is weaker in the originals, aiding opposition groups in hostile regimes. And an original phrase describing a group made up of bullies and country bumpkins is in number 10's version, just bullies, editing to make Saddam's apparatus look more terrifying, raising questions about the way number 10 is spinning the justification for war.
Julian Rush, well, I called Downing Street for reaction. Their minister was available, and intriguingly, actually, the Tory opposition didn't want to talk about it either. Downing Street offered this statement. Our report was put together by a range of government officials. The report makes this clear. The contents were drawn from a number of sources, including intelligence material. First paragraph only, I gather. The report does not identify or credit any sources, nor does it claim exclusivity on its contents. We consider the text as published accurate. The Downing Street spokesman would not be drawn on whether this included the typos and spelling mistakes.
Okay, so what are you looking at? And people always ask me, what was your immediate reaction to be plagiarized by the British government? It wasn't that it highlighted my poor use of commas. My most immediate reaction, what kind of infuriated me most, was they copied my chart. This very complicated chart that I compiled that more or less put together the complicated, convoluted, and confusing nature of the security sector under Saddam Hussein. So just for a reference, the security sector refers to those forces beyond the conventional military that are usually charged with maintaining domestic security. In some states, they might be paramilitary forces. Now, the importance is not just the confusion, but the numbers that I highlighted in terms of how many individuals were mobilized in each one of these organizations. Collectively, it was about, lowest estimate, about 80,000 figures in the Iraqi security sector, maybe as high as 100,000. Okay. Why are those numbers important? Because, number one, let's look at the reference to the 10 to 15,000 country bumpkins in the news report. Okay. Those quote-unquote country bumpkins were referred to in a military unit known as the Fedayeen Saddam. Controlled by Saddam's son. When that news report came out, there was kind of a hidden message in my research, okay? And it's this. With these 100,000 individuals, those country bumpkins, says a lot. Where do those country bumpkins primarily come from? They came from Tikrit. You see, This network projected fear in Iraqi society. It was also a job provider for the various segments of Iraqi society that were the key to regime security. So this became a question that I was the main point of my article, was this: what happens if this security sector is demobilized, if it's managed properly, okay? It might avoid this scenario, and this was my fear. If this is network is demobilized overnight, what does that mean? You have 100,000 men, proficient in the use of arms, okay, with no future and stake in the new Iraqi government. So when I say how is this related to human security, I'm not talking about in terms of human security in regards to these individuals who committed some horrific crimes. And human security, I mean, what threat does a demobilized security sector mean for the Iraqi population? And my argument is the Iraqi population endured that threat for the last 20 years, more or less. Okay. You see, when this document was plagiarized in February 2003, let's look at February 2023. The date this was plagiarized, and I saw a lot of symbolism, what happened within the span of a week? Number one, a prominent Iraqi environmentalist, Jassim Al-Assadi, was kidnapped on a major road on the way to Baghdad. The same week, a prominent Iraqi YouTuber named Tibar Lali, who had just come back to visit Iraq, was kidnapped by her father and killed in an honor killing. So in other words, the symbolism of the timing is this. 20 years later, this back-to-back events happening in the same week, 20 years after the plagiarism, forced me to ponder a question. If security sector reform had been managed properly, okay, and this is one of the great counterfactuals, would events like these, just these two that I picked, still be occurring 20 years from now? Because you see, the answer to my fears, okay, were realized on May 23rd in a single order, and I think this was the most consequential decision made in Iraq's past, and the ramifications which are still being felt 20 years later. What happened after I was plagiarized? I did have to go to the British Parliament, and testify in one of the many inquiries that lasted for almost close to a decade in terms of understanding the case to go to war against Iraq. My greatest regret was, during those testimonies, was to say the wrong lesson was taken from the plagiarism. It wasn't copying the information, but asking this question: what would the ramifications be of security sector reform that wasn't managed properly? What happened was not only the complete disbandment of a lot of organizations you saw on my chart, that's what I underlined, okay? What was unfathomable was the complete demobilization of the Iraqi military. Remember, my concern was what would happen with 100,000 individuals being demobilized and what threat would they pose to Iraqi society. Remember, the Iraqi army, more or less, its size at one time was about 1 million men under arms. So that, I think, becomes one of the most important issues, is not only the collapse of the security sector, but the Iraqi military itself being demobilized, where the US military then found itself in a role where it had to serve the function of the Iraqi military without the sufficient numbers to do that. And so what am I going to be presenting then from this point onwards are the consequences of this decision. This is my argument. This was one of the most consequential decisions made in Iraqi history in the last 20 years. Because not only did you deprive Iraq of some kind of mechanism or the institutions to maintain security, but this demobilization also basically gave the fuel in terms of the training, the grievances for the Iraqi insurgency. This is what I was looking at. Now, let's look at two consequences of this decision. You see, all of these agencies projected fear into Iraqi society. But for the most part, if we look at this network, even though it was complicated, it was collectively referred to as the Mukhabarat. And like I said, if these individuals were not somehow rehabilitated or reintegrated, some were criminals and should be tried, right? So to sum up now, one of the first speakers you had was Ali Alawi, who began this lecture series, if I'm not mistaken. So if you want to go back in 2003, what were Ali Alawi and I, who was also, he was a fellow at St. Anthony, so I was working with him in 2003. What was our biggest concern? So I was looking at this from the security element. Ali Alawi was wondering what kind of process would Iraq have that would be somewhat akin to the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa. This was his big concern. Now, of course, he was cognizant of the difficulties of applying a South African model to a society like Iraq, where, you know, the South African model had these televised confessions, if you will, and then forgiveness from the perpetrators televised in this live session. He knew that would be difficult, but still he argued that there were lessons that should have been applied to this particular case. This was a particular, of course, concern that we had. Now, at the end of the day, what happened? It's quite interesting. 2003, this is what you have, one of the first collapses of the mass mobilization armies in Middle Eastern history. Like I said, it's almost kind of foreshadowing different circumstances, but 2003, one of the largest Arab armies in the Middle East now no longer exists. It almost foreshadows, or kind of is a precursor to the collapse of the Syrian military. That was ranking number two. Collapse of the Libyan army. I mean, leaving, if we're talking about kind of Arab militaries right now, if we talk about one of the largest that's still relatively intact, it's the Egyptian military. So on one level, 2003 represented the end of the mass mobilization army. Again, we still have to acknowledge this was a military that not only engaged in two wars with the U.S., it was also a military force that used its arsenal and weapons, not the regular military, but primarily the Republican Guard, against Iraq's population during the uprising in 1991. And again, I see a lot of a kind of foreshadowing of how the Syrian military, its equivalent of the Republican Guards, would do that against its own civilian population, or the elite Praetorian units of Gaddafi's military. So kind of in the history of security sectors, what was happening in Iraq, even though it was induced by the American invasion and its collapse, but there were trends that would be foreshadowed in the Middle East in the future. But nonetheless, so that fateful decision incentivized thousands of Iraqi men in the security services, as well as the army, proficient in the use of arms to foment an insurgency, or augment the ranks of jihadist extremist networks that would later go on to foment an Iraqi civil war from 2006 to 2008. So I'll briefly deal with that episode and then take us up to the present. Now, Iraq's security sector, as I documented in my work, was brutal under Saddam Hussein. But violence, such as kidnappings or gender-based violence, was primarily inflicted by the state. In other words, if you were kidnapped, it was most likely the Mukhabarat. Even gender-based violence was committed by these forces. The Fedayeen Saddam once had a notorious campaign of going through the streets of Baghdad and beheading alleged prostitutes and leaving their decapitated heads on the door. That was gender-based violence, right? The state was the site of violence primarily in the Iraqi society. After 2003, Iraqis endured violence from a myriad of sources, not only from the foreign occupying sources. So we have to remember, the occupying US military forces was a source of violence to Iraqi society, whether it was a poor family going through a stop sign or incidents of American soldiers entering an Iraqi home and raping a young girl and killing the entire family. So it's the foreign occupying sources who become a source of violence. But those forces would leave. But that leaves us with the collapse of the Iraqi security sector, Iraqi criminal gangs, militias, tribes, and even one's own family members could get away with crimes such as honor killings without facing any repercussions. Something unheard of, that somebody committed an honor killing without getting punished or coming under the, being tried by the Mukhabarat institutions under Saddam Hussein. All of which emerged as a result of the invasion. To boot, the post-Saddam security sector, both Kurdish and Arab security forces, are not as effective as their predecessors, despite US training. Yet they also project violence into Iraqi society, targeting civil society activists and protesters. Okay, so that's my overview of the ramifications of the collapse of the security sector. Now we'll look at just some digital primary sources around the time of the emergence of this particular figure that it seemed like the new Iraqi security forces and the US military just simply could not catch, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. a Jordanian. And if you see, these are actually Iraqi images of basically wondering how could the most advanced US military not capture this person. From 2004 to 2006, he more or less established a network in Iraq that would be the precursor that would eventually evolve into the Islamic State of Iraq, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, and eventually evolve into ISIS itself. Zarqawi was eventually killed in 2006 by an American airstrike. But his final legacy would be unleashing a civil war in Iraq as the result of the destruction of the shrine in Samarra. Okay. And this episode from 2006 to 2008, that civil war is significant, and I'll tell you how so. I know Iraqis who might have not, let's say, personally been affected by the 2003 war, never mind the 1991 war. In other words, they lived, none of their relatives were killed. I know Iraqis who've endured the sanctions. What I found quite fascinating was that almost every Iraqi I knew that was remaining in Iraq after 2003 somehow was affected by that sectarian civil war. That almost every Iraqi family, whether it's Arab, Sunni, or Shia, Christian, so on and so forth, lost somebody in this conflict. An intense round of bloodletting for 2 years, including my family, as a result of this action. So, that's the sectarian civil war. Now, this lecture is also kind of a collection of the primary sources I've been collecting over the last 20 years, or pictures I've taken during my journeys. This was a picture I took in 2004. And I want you to focus on this figure here, Muqtada al-Sadr. And just kind of notice almost he's surrounded by a trinity, by these images of various Shia imams. Here we have him as well. Muqtada al-Sadr. The background is not Iraq, if I'm not mistaken. This is Devil's Arch, which I think is in Utah. I don't think Muqtada is saying I'm going to take a vacation to the U.S. But why is this figure significant? So let's look at the evolution. Who was this figure in 2003 and 2004? Number one, what did he represent? First of all, the survivor of a prominent cleric, Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, who was killed. Like I said, if Iraqis are killed, it's primarily by the Mukhabarat. His father was killed by the Mukhabarat. He's the last remaining member of the family, but he also represented a Shia network that remained Iraq, unlike a good number of various clerics who were exiled. In 2003-2004, the US forces tried to arrest him. From that point onwards, what begins is, I talked about an insurgency with elements related to Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi. The Sadrists were another element of the insurgency that US forces weren't able to defeat or dismantle. Now, to bring these two events together, here I am in Samarra in 2010. The civil war had begun to abate. But a lot of the sectarian killing, at least from the Shia side, we knew who was doing it from the primarily Arab Sunni side or the Arab tribal side, were factions within the Sadrists that even Sadr himself lost control of. A good number of the original Shia militias didn't emerge after the invasion of ISIS. There were more or less breakaway groups that were encouraged to break away by Iran. Basically, with the Sadrist militia, it was a single faction that broke away from Sadr, again at the behest of Iran. And I think Iran in this day had, at that moment, had a vision that that would be akin to Iran's Hezbollah in Iraq. And in fact, they took the name of Iraq's Hezbollah Brigade. Right? Then what happened was probably it was that faction, because Sadr was always, even though he was, you know, Shia cleric, he always had this message, back even in 2004, that Iraq's Arab Sunnis and Shia should find a modus vivendi, that they should unite and cooperate in expelling the American occupation. That faction not only probably was responsible for a lot of the sectarian killing, but then further splints occurred within that organization. So I made a mistake. The first breakaway was a group called Asab Ahlul Haq. From that organization, another group called Kitab al-Hezbollah broke away from Kitab al-Hezbollah, another organization broke away. That unified, cohesive Hezbollah never immersed in Iran, notwithstanding how many times I've heard that Iran has put the Hezbollah model in Iraq. That description doesn't hold much water, but let's now look at the consequences. Like I said, what has been lost is a kind of heterogeneity in Iraq. This is one of the examples, one of the legacies of the Iraqi civil war in 2008, was that Baghdad, a city that was mixed, is now more or less where you could have members of any community living, let's say, on a single street. What we see, this was back in 2010 when I visited Iraq, where you had almost something akin to now, you know, homogenous, monolithic, ethno-sectarian neighborhoods. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, this is a wonderful interface called A Web of Terror, where if you ever want to go and look at kind of every single terrorist attack committed since World War II, it's more or less mapped here. What is the legacy of this organization that was kind of a branch of Al-Qaeda? Again, one of the laments was almost genocide of Iraq's Yazidi population. And I just to show you kind of just images of the kind of Iraq's mosaic that was suffered as a result of ISIS. Chaldean churches, for example, here, a mosaic of St. George slaying the dragon being defaced by ISIS, which, in my opinion, was the dragon that came to Iraq. So, with all of these events then, this question was raised. Who said this? The very existence of Iraq as a distinct sovereign entity had become uncertain. And for those of you who kind of don't remember, there were certain junctures in Iraq's history where sentiments like this were expressed. Now, who said this? It's actually the editor of Iraq's first anthology of science fiction stories. You see, why was the editor saying this? And if you notice a name here, Ibrahim al-Marashi, I contributed to this science fiction. Even though I was a historian, why did I write a science fiction story? Because more or less every single one of these writers, we couldn't help but to write our projection of Iraq in 100 years, being influenced by the rise of ISIS. Because the rise of ISIS again raised that question, how long would this terrorist state let endure? And did its invasion more or less result in a de facto partition of Iraq? Where would the Kurdish parts of Iraq be on their way to independence anyway, had the Iraqi state failed? So now let's go to this element. Iraq Plus 100 is a book that was written where we projected Iraq 100 years later. This lecture is called Iraq Plus 20, where we're looking at over the last 20 years what happened. So again, let us look at not only, in other words, what does this map represent? It's a reflection of the time. This is what I was trying to collect, okay? Where basically somebody said, his name was Ralph Peters, now a retired American lieutenant colonel, a prominent pundit on Fox News. So if we talk about, remember, this is a time when President Bush was president, Fox News was more or less the cheerleader of the Iraq War, okay? Where basically he was saying, not only let's let Iraq collapse, but let's bring down the collapse of the entire Middle East state system. Now, this was his most extreme manifestation of this kind of hubris. But remember, there were terms. Look at this, where in 2018, there were ideas that there were such entities that we could call an Iraqi Sunnistan, a Shiastan, okay? Now you might say, okay, these are more or less pundits extrapolating scenarios, or this, you know, it's a science fiction editor who's wondering would the Iraqi state persist. But then again, who wrote this article? And really it reflected, and this is the other one I'm trying to give you, is kind of the zeitgeist of the time of the Iraqi insurgency. Unity through autonomy in Iraq was more or less a plan to make Iraq like Bosnia. Okay, you might say, so what is the New York Times editorial written by Joseph Biden, okay, back in 2006? Okay. Now, it's quite interesting because look what he says here. It is increasingly clear that Bush does not have a strategy for victory in Iraq. Rather, he hopes to prevent defeat and pass the problem along to his successor, which more or less would be President Obama and Biden as vice president. Now, so let's look at this particular case. And back in 2006, Biden was saying Iraq should become like Bosnia. Now, if you're anyone familiar with kind of the state of Bosnia as of 2023, it itself is a dysfunctional political entity. Okay. But really back then, the way, if you have to remember that time, was the fighting in Iraq was seen very much akin to the Bosnian Civil War. So really what this vision was what was so-called soft partition. Okay. Now, let's reflect. It's quite interesting that once it went to the defeat and pass the problem along to his successor, let's look at what were some expectations on the eve of 2003 and what became the reality by almost 10 years into the Iraq War. The U.S. withdrew, and to everyone's surprise, did not get a military base, as was expected, not even in the Kurdistan Regional Government. And not only that, a status of forces agreement could not even be agreed upon. For the most part, it was a complete withdrawal, despite the expectations that even a residual force in Iraq would stay as of 2011. Simply, that status of forces agreements could not be agreed upon. So on one level, this was not achieved. Second, despite the rhetoric of this war being a war for oil, again, another surprise emerged. Who did benefit? Who were the victors in Iraq's oil sector? Well, if you look at the groups that I highlighted, they weren't members of the Coalition of the Willing. Okay. It's the China National Oil Company, Petronas of Malaysia, and Total. Okay. The China National Petroleum there, and even a very, at this time it's hard to fathom, that ExxonMobil could work with the Russian company Lukoil to extract Iraqi gas. What happened to everyone's surprise? Despite all the progress of the rhetoric that this was a war for oil, the Iraqi government did launch a very transparent Iraqi oil bidding process, at that time under Iraqi foreign oil minister Hussein Shahristani, where oil contracts were not awarded to a particular oil company based on its origin. The bid had to be submitted anonymously. And hence when you got this outcome, where you see very few American companies. I mean, if you look at the Coalition of the Willing, it's really only Eni there, the Italian energy giant, that got access to the field, and again, because it submitted a very just reasonable proposal. Repsol, the Spanish government's energy oil network, which was part of the so-called Coalition of the Willing, did not get rewarded a contract. So, I want to use this map now to kind of reflect on the region as we conclude. Remember back in 2003, the US at that time was present in Afghanistan. The Taliban was almost defeated. Okay. The US was in Iraq, and remember the sentiment there, particularly was that Syria and Iran would be next. Okay. With that momentum, and it might be hard to imagine, but there was genuine calls and saying, now that Iraq has succeeded, Iran is gonna fall, Syria is gonna fall. In 2003, it says a lot that Ayatollah Khamenei was willing to negotiate with the U.S. at that point over its nuclear program, over its support of proxy militias in the Middle East, over its ballistic missile program back in 2003. That offer was rebuffed back in 2003. Now, what is the irony? What has been the final obstacle of the U.S. re-entering the Iran deal? The U.S. is saying, offer us these things that it was more than willing to do back in 2003. Here's the irony. Now, if we look at this, what was the other ramification of the 2003 Iraq War? Iraq used to be known as the eastern flank of the Arab world. As of 2003, with the demobilization of the Iraqi military, the eastern flank collapsed. Back in early 2006, the King of Jordan talked about a Shia arc going from Iran reaching the Mediterranean. It was not an inevitability, but it happened partly, I don't think by design, but by circumstances well beyond Iran's control. Okay? Remember, it was the U.S. decision to disband the Iraqi military. Okay? But again, Iran was at that time willing to negotiate with the US. When that offer was rebuffed and Syria felt threatened, here you had two of Iraq's neighbors that had an incentive to support the insurgency. And like I said, to its surprise, the US did not maintain a strong military presence in Iraq. Okay, Syria again would eventually come undone, okay, giving Iran the ability to project more influence not only into Iraq, into Syria. But despite that, it wasn't, people keep on saying that Iraq is dominated by Iran. It's too simplistic to say that. Number one, on some levels, right? What did Iran also witness? The revival of Najaf as a clerical institution. And that perhaps presents almost a greater threat to the Islamic Republic, at least to its legitimacy or its claim to be the sole leader of Shia Islam. That to this very day, and this is a picture I took of Najaf, I just liked it because in this, not only has this institution come back to serve as kind of a rival to the Iranian networks and clone, I just find it so funny that there's a sign for pizza right before you enter. That's the only reason I do that, okay? Now, like I said, Iran also wasn't able to get that pliant Hezbollah in Iraq. In fact, what you have, these are the various banners of a, I don't know how to describe it, a constellation of Shia militias. And a good number of them, get Iranian support. But this is also the other thing that, despite the odds, what did Iraq survive? What's an Iranian-US proxy war? And this is a bit more in recent history, is that one of its leaders of one of these militias and an Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, was assassinated on Iraqi soil. Do you remember in January 2020, what was the most widely Googled search term? How did World War III break out? Because remember, what was the anticipation that this assassination, like an assassination in Sarajevo, might set up a conflict that might spiral out of control? Okay. In other words, if we look at kind of the significance, is somehow Iraq has balanced the US and Iran in this proxy war. Okay. In other words, Iraq surviving despite the odds. Iraq, let's go back prior to 2003, weathered the longest conventional war of the 20th century, the Iran-Iraq War, followed by one of the shortest, the 1991 Gulf War, then the 1991 uprisings that swept through 15 of its 18 provinces, then a decade of sanctions. Then the 2003 war happened. So let's now kind of, let me list what I've described. It witnessed an occupation from 2003 to 2011, the collapse of its national military in 2003, an insurgency from 2003 to 2008, a civil war from 2006 to 2008, and then the terrorist statelet of ISIS from 2014 to 2018. ISIS is more or less still in Iraq, primarily in the Diyala provinces, and still conducts terrorist attacks. Iraq witnessed the genocide against the Yazidi population, ethnic cleansing of the Syrian, Chaldean, and I'll talk a bit later of the Mandean population. It survived an aborted bid for Kurdish independence in 2017. It has endured a sustained protest movement, the constituents of which are Shia by virtue of its geographic location. It's the Shia left behind protesting against the Shia elite. A proxy war between the US and Iran that more or less has, I would say, I would date back to 2003. It weathered a pandemic. And you also have to understand that not just the a COVID pandemic, but a startling mental health pandemic, where the numbers I hear range from 1 to 3 to 1 to 5 Iraqis report having mental health issues without the infrastructure to cope with this problem. And now having listed all of that, now I'm bringing in the climate, you see. You see, so despite the odds, if we're looking at the history of the Arab state system, it has endured quite a lot of shocks. This is what I was just trying to get you to appreciate it, and how much doubt was there? Okay. Now, before I talk, I just finished with the climate strategy, right? How did Iraq survive? So this is my assessment. It survived because the region, its neighbors, wanted Iraq to survive as a nation, albeit also an advantage of Iraq surviving, albeit weaker than it was under Saddam Hussein. Whether it be Iran, Kuwait, definitely, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, definitely, as well as Syria. Syria lost its Baathist rival, and Turkey to the extent where, as long as the Kurds don't declare independence, all were factors that kept Iraq intact from the regional level. Okay? The U.S. wanted it intact. Even with the 2017 vote, the U.S. was one of the most adamant opponents for such a unilateral move. But also, the Iraqis, we tend to forget, wanted Iraq intact. Iraq's Shia population, it's hard to talk about them as a current political faction, but those who happen to be Shia were finally now in power. They, if you wanted the whole pie. Okay? And of course, even there was a Kurdish incoherence that we have to admit kept Iraq intact, that the Kurdish bid for independence, that if you talk, on the political level, there was always talk of Kurdish independence. And I teach Kurdish students every year in Prague, and they all dream of independence, but even they did not want independence under these circumstances. The divide between the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and the KDP, the two dominant parties, is pronounced, okay, to this very day, and this is what I mean by Kurdish incoherence. So what do we have then? We do have a state that over 20 years has survived, despite a moment when we really thought there would be a coup, when Nouri al-Maliki was threatening to mobilize units loyal to him after the chaos with ISIS from 2014 to 2015. The coup never materialized, even though there was an expectation of it. And finally, a Shia civil war that was talked about last summer still has yet to, fortunately did not materialize. Okay. So now kind of as a final conclusion, a good number of Iraq's problems were man-made outside of Iraq's borders, I would say. All, you know, consequences of primarily the U.S. invasion, combined with poor governance within Iraq. And I think that's also going to be the problem with climate change. These are man-made problems. A good number are problems that are created beyond Iraq's borders, but then local governance is also going to exacerbate matters. So I'll just show you just kind of a couple of slides showing us the problem. Okay. 63.5 degrees in Baghdad, Celsius, that is. What are the ramifications of temperatures like this? Now, when I'm showing you temperatures like this, you have to realize, remember where you were during the 2019 summer heat wave. And it's easy to remember. It was the last vacation you took without wearing masks or having to worry about COVID vaccines, right? And if you remember how hot that was, Iraq and Kuwait, that area there, witnessed the hottest temperatures in Earth's, since we were recording temperatures, in the history of recording temperatures of climate. How is this going to affect Iraq? It's going to have a variety of ramifications. I just want to show kind of from a gendered perspective. I do argue that there is a gendered component here. Women are going to be disproportionately affected, because when I talk about gendering the Anthropocene, if we look at these beekeepers in Diyala, okay, or let's say cattle herders or fisher, people who do fishing in the marshes, a good number of them are female head of households due to the wars with ISIS or the assassination of the head of households. We don't realize now most of the heads of families in these particular areas are women, right? Without water, you don't have the necessary flora and fauna for bees to pollinate. Okay, it's the same problem in the marshes. Okay, and again, if we look at just from a climate perspective, those oil fields I was talking about, Iraq will be disproportionately affected in terms of not only climate change, but then the toxic legacies, not only of three wars, but the burning of hydrocarbons. Okay. Remember, Basra is home to a large Afro-Iraqi population. Now, look at this term I came up with, climate apartheid is not mine. This is a term developed by Desmond Tutu, where in this particular case, I looked at how would climate change affect, let's say, Basra's Afro-Iraqi population compared to Colombia's African population. What I argue is climate change is going to be concurrent with poverty, and the way it's going to be experienced is quite different. And then here we get to kind of Iraq in our imagination, in the global imagination, the site of the Garden of Eden. And here, if you look at this particular community, the Mandaeans are facing two threats. Not only were they threatened by various militias who were displacing them from the south of Iraq, but this is a kind of an interesting faith, a community that claims a kind of neo-Gnostic faith where they revere John the Baptist, and thus baptism is integral to their faith. Okay. Just like the Yazidis, the Mandaeans are a community whose faith is strictly and solely connected to the land where they come from. Okay. And this is what I mean by the loss of Iraq's heterogeneity. With the Yazidis, it was as a result of ISIS. In the case of the Mandaeans, it's the combination of, let's look at it, hotter temperatures are leading to more evaporation. The damming of the rivers in Turkey are leading to less flow of water coming down. And then let's not forget the act of political ecology committed under Saddam Hussein, the draining of the marshes. Okay. The marshes were restored, but in that intervening time, there was irreparable damage that started to cause more intense sandstorms. Just so I can show you, this is a picture of Basra, and if you can't see it exactly. I'll show you this, just to kind of reflect on my own personal experience. This is a sandstorm in Kalamia. It's 3 p.m. And this is what I was saying, because Dubai, Kuwait, the Khalid experiences sandstorm, but I was saying Iraq is something that is quite unusual. Even for my mom and father, they had never witnessed this kind of intensity. So that's the Shrine of Kalamia. And then this is not rain, they're just particles of hard sand droplets. Just to show you. And then literally a minute later, it's all clear. And that's what I'm saying, it's literally 3 p.m., but these are kind of anomalous sandstorms where now it's even providing kind of a health hazard in terms of people now being hospitalized because the intensity and frequency is a lot more. So as to conclude now, I mean, to make, you know, Iraq, in terms of kind of the story we've told of civilization, and the environmental historian Felipe Fernandez Ernesto has his problems with civilization. For him, it's kind of, it's a subjective term, but let's just go with it. Okay. Iraq is, of course, considered in our story of modern, or civilization, the birthplace of not only civilization, but the site of many good parts of the, Bible itself. And yes, what are we witnessing in Iraq? If civilization began here and set us on a trajectory to modern civilization, now this is the question, then will it also be in Iraq where modern civilization first begins to unravel due to these kind of fluctuations? These are things to think about. Now, I don't want to end on such a pessimistic note, right? Remember Jassim Alessidi, who was kidnapped in February? He was eventually released. We don't know, he hasn't told us who kidnapped him or how he was released. There is notes for optimism. And it's finally this, and it relates to where I'm giving my presentation. Okay? In the 1930s, an Iraqi politician named Mohammed Hadid had a vision of a binational Iraq. An Iraq where the Kurds were given autonomy, but also stake in the system. A state where Iraq's Sunnis and Shias could cooperate in the name of modernization and development, right? That was Mohammed Hadid's vision in the 1930s. And for all of you who don't know it, we have the legacy of his daughter's work in this building that she designed right here. And so this is where I conclude for some notes of optimism. The last 20 years have been difficult, but we also have to acknowledge that. This is also an opportunity Mohammed Hadid's vision is manifesting itself. And on that kind of note, there is some room for optimism in the next 20 years. Thank you so much. Oh, and just some further reading if you want. I wrote this for International Women's Day on Wednesday. This article talking about the problem of honor killings in Iraq. It deserves its own lecture. I didn't do a good justice. And then finally, if you want to know more about the environment, an excellent lecture on the Middle East Center's series of podcasts, which I believe you chaired. What does political ecology tell us about the environment? This was also, if you want to learn about Iraq's environmental problems, by a proper political ecologist. And yes, if you want to keep in touch or if you have questions in the future that weren't articulated during the Q&A. Thank you.